This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Richard Handler is an anthropologist at the University of Virginia, and he joins us in studio. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
I got a million things I'd love to talk to you about, and the folks who know me well know that I studied anthropology in graduate school, and you were actually one of my professors. So of course I've got a bunch of questions, but the best place to start is just to sort of a Richard Handler 101, your background, how you got into anthropology. It's not the kind of thing that kids sit on the school ground when they're little on the playground and say, I'm going to be an anthropologist when I grow up.
No, and you know, many people, the common conception of an anthropologist is as an archaeologist, and which is part of our discipline, but more of us are what we call social or cultural anthropologists than archaeologists. And cultural anthropology, the study of cultural diversity around the globe, is kind of, it's a wonderful way to see and think about worlds that are quite different from our own. And I guess I was always inclined that way, to a contrarian thinker, you might say, from fairly early on in life. And I encountered anthropology as an undergraduate in the 1960s at Columbia University, and it made a lot of sense to me. And eventually I went to graduate school at the University of Chicago, and in 1986 I was very lucky and got a teaching position at the University of Virginia, where I've been ever since.
I remember when I was an undergraduate at William & Mary, I was pre-law. Mm. And back in the time when I thought that, well, if you didn't know science, you went to law school. If you could understand science, you went to medical school. And I remember reading a book called by E. Adamson Hobel, The Law of Primitive Man.
Yes, I remember that.
Every chapter is this, well, here's what law is among the Eskimo or among some Indian tribe in South America. And it's like the box that my brain lived in just exploded, and all of a sudden I understood law cross-culturally, that it was much bigger and more complicated than in the West as I had always thought it to be.
Yeah, you know, and students today, with the emphasis on globalization and on cultural diversity, a lot of students at a place like UVA, although they too, like you, are pre-law or pre-med, they really want to think about and talk about other places and global issues. And an anthropology course, and I love teaching these large courses for beginning students, an anthropology course oftentimes does what you said it did to you. It really gets to them.
Right, right.
And they may still go to law school or med school, and many of our anthropology majors do. And the med schools and law schools like that, actually. But it does open up their thinking in a way that they like. So,
anthropologist Richard Handler is our guest. The phone lines are open at 977-1070. What's the elevator speech for anthropology when you run into somebody who maybe never had a course? Most times you run into somebody who will say, you know, I took an anthropology course in college.
Well, you know, it's awkward because it turns out they're thinking of archaeology often.
Indiana Jones.
Yeah, and then they want to know the difference between sociology and anthropology. And the simple answer to that is that sociologists tend to study our own society, where anthropology is the discipline in the curriculum that has responsibility for all the places and times that other disciplines don't study. But that if they have some understanding of cultural anthropology, then they place you on a remote island in the South Seas or something.
Right. Margaret
Mead, who is, of course, the most famous of all anthropologists. Although I must tell you, I taught a class last semester to 18 first-year students, 18-year-olds, and none of them had heard of Margaret Mead.
Wow.
Which really surprised me.
Is that the first year that's happened to you?
Yes.
That's really interesting, actually.
Yeah.
Sort of culture turning over, you know.
That's right. And, you know, so anyway, then the next step is to tell them that not only do anthropologists study strange places, what I call the bongo bongo, but we study in the United States or modern societies because, after all, there is no culture stranger than American culture. and lots of anthropologists are now into that.
And there's even a whole subfield now of cultural anthropology, business or corporate anthropology, where you have anthropologists who are spending their field work at IBM, for example,
studying
the culture of a workplace and then reporting back to the board of how maybe they can make improvements to improve that workplace.
Yeah, and in fact, I was on the Dick and Jane show, I don't know, a year ago or something, talking about work that I did at Colonial Williamsburg, and that was a study of a nonprofit corporation, and it was a, we were positioned as outside critics. They allowed us to do that, but you're right. You can go into a business organization and try to figure. Businesses want to know about their own organizational culture, and they have, of course, purposes. They want to try to improve things as they understand improvement, and then that becomes an issue for you know, academic anthropologists aren't necessarily used to producing research that can be used in that way or can be ordered in that way. On the other hand, some anthropologists go into consulting and end up doing that kind of thing. And it's fascinating. These big corporations are fascinating.
Anthropologist Richard Handler is our guest, and we also want to let folks know that you are an associate dean at the University of Virginia.
Yeah, so I've had firsthand what we would call native experience with a very complicated bureaucracy, which is which is kind of endlessly fascinating. So yeah, I've been the dean of the undergraduate college at UVA for 7 years, and as I say, it's been quite interesting.
I've heard more than one Virginia governor, and actually Governor Kane has told me personally that from their experience, some of the most challenging bureaucracies in Virginia today are the big universities, that they are a mystery to some of the folks in Richmond.
That's probably true, although I don't have the comparative perspective because I haven't studied Richmond bureaucracies. but it is true that business bureaucracies are not like academic bureaucracies. There's a different value system operating in each. And oftentimes some of the good friends of the university who are business people and help us a lot with money and so on, they sometimes talk to us about running the place more like a business. And, you know, they're right in the sense that we have to use resources as well as we can. I won't say they're wrong, but sometimes they don't understand that what counts as productivity for us is not necessarily what can be put on a bottom line. So you can see the kind of clash of cultures that or business organizations and academic organizations when you work with these very engaged donors who are trying to help us.
Right, because UVA is not producing widgets.
That's exactly right.
It's much harder to gauge
the
success of any school.
Yeah, and in higher education today, and this comes from, I think, from the corporate world and from government, there's a lot of discussion of a so-called assessment and a desire to know that tax dollars are being spent well and that our students are learning something. And I deal with that as a bureaucrat or an administrator. But as a teacher, you know, you go in the classroom and you do the best you can and you see sort of the students light up and you talk to them on and off hours. And I kind of take it for granted that a lot of them are getting a lot out of it, and I don't really care to attach a number to that. So then the problem becomes when somebody outside wants to know what the students are in fact learning. And when a professor says, well, I know they're learning, that's not enough of an answer.
Yeah. Well, one of the good things here at the University of Virginia is that, we can point to some numbers of some terrific graduation rates, the best in the country at any public university for African American students. And,
I think it's the best, among publics for all students too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, but of course the problem is what do the numbers mean? and we know that we do know that students love UVA, and UVA is very good, or at least the College of Arts and Sciences, which is where I work, and that's the largest unit. We're very tightly run to encourage and, in fact, force students to go through expeditiously. And students would stay longer at UVA if they could.
Yeah, I'm sure they would.
As Charlottesville residents well know.
Richard Handler is our guest, anthropologist and associate dean at the University of Virginia. Richard, you and I spoke recently by email about some articles that have been out recently in the New Yorker, and this one by George Packer comes to mind, titled Knowing the Enemy, the general gist of which is that the thing that is missing most, perhaps, at the upper levels of leadership and government here in the West, and I guess it could be argued for every industrial country, but definitely in America, is the presence of anthropologists, is the presence
of
people
who have that kind of knowledge.
Right, folks who really understand other cultures and have an inkling of cultural relativity. Flesh this out for us. What's the thinking there?
Well, at your suggestion, I looked at read the article, and of course that's the argument that given the kinds of struggles or issues that we're engaged with around the world, we need to know a lot more about the people we're dealing with, and not knowing about them leads to various kinds of blunders or policies that are unsuccessful. anthropologists or academic anthropologists are very hesitant to go to work for the Defense Department, although some do. And one could argue there should be more anthropologists providing that kind of knowledge to help defense policies or foreign policies be more humane, more useful or more practical. In World War II, anthropologists and social scientists in many disciplines committed themselves heavily to the war effort. That's a very famous episode in the history of anthropology and the other social sciences. But, of course, the Second World War was not one about which many people were ambivalent in the United States, or at least not after Pearl Harbor, whereas it's not clear that the war on terrorism is that kind of a war, the so-called war on terrorism is that kind of a war. So it's obvious that the United States government and various agencies of the government, if they want to deal successfully with peoples elsewhere, need to know things about those peoples that Americans, with their limited exposure to other cultures and other languages, often don't know. Another side of the equation is that Americans tend, because of the kind of ideology or culture of our country, which our belief in our own greatness, we tend to assume that we should be leading others and that others want to be like us. And sometimes it's hard for us to imagine that other places are different and want to be different and don't want to be like us. So another thing that anthropology can contribute to the debate is to give leaders a better sense of the fact that our own culture is quite local. It's global right now because of our power, but that's a recent phenomena that probably won't last.
I was having a conversation with someone recently, and they were saying, don't these people understand we're just trying to free them, and don't they want to be free? And I said, that may be true on your part, but they may not define freedom like you do. Yeah. They may define freedom as having religious leaders run the government.
Right. And that's a sort of a classic problem in classic question. Terms, which is, can terms like freedom be applied across all cultures, or do all cultures have a similar concept and mean something like the same thing? And it is true, I must tell you in the audience, that the last 2 days in class, this big class I'm teaching, this has been the issue where I argue with the students and I say, we organize our families in terms of a concept called love, but it's not clear that other places organize their families that way. And the students, then they want to say, well, they may not call it love, but it's the same thing, isn't it? And that's a great sort of question in philosophy, really. And my answer to that is that we can translate a French poem, but our translation isn't the same thing as the French poem. So we can translate their concepts about family, and we can call it love, but our family system is still not, it's still not the same as what they're doing, even though we can understand it and talk about it, and it looks something like our concept of love.
And Richard, this disconnect that anthropology tries, that the anthropology speaks to, that between cultures, really can get us into a lot of trouble. I mean, it really can, and you've studied this. I mean, it really, this sense of nationalism that, well, we have the right way, and this is the right way. And if you're not doing it exactly like we are, then we need to teach you how to do it, because
yeah,
our
is,
way is the right way. We have the right values. We have the right interpretation of reality. And, we often have leaders that will try to enforce that at the end of a gun.
That's the history of the expansion of the modern world in the last 400 years. And it's a hard thing to think about globally, because so much of what's come out of the modern West in interaction with the rest of the world has spread, has been adopted. Let's say the system of nation states, and people do want our technology, let's say, or some of our medical knowledge, but they don't necessarily want everything, and they don't necessarily understand it the way we understand it. So it's a very tricky problem to think about, as we spread aspects of our culture, which people seem to want, but then they don't always want it, and they sometimes certainly don't want it at all and rebel against it.
Now, I know you have, so Richard Handler, our guest, you've spent a great part of your career studying this whole idea of
nationalism.
What is it you think that most people perhaps don't understand or don't get about nationalism and tease out some of these primary points that have come out of your scholarship.
Yeah, well, I should tell everyone that my first fieldwork project, a long time ago in the 70s and early 80s, was in Quebec, and probably our listeners know that for 200 years there's been an independence movement in Quebec. There are people in Quebec who want to break away from Canada, and it's a French-speaking versus English-speaking social conflict. So I stumbled on that as a graduate student and ended up studying it for several years and writing a book about it. And so I have thought a lot about nationalist ideologies. And the key feature of these ideologies is that a nation should be united, and to be united is to share certain ways of doing things, certain ideas, things like language or culture or history or tradition. Now, the trick is, and this you find this out when you study nationalisms or nationalist movements, either in the present or historically, turns out no one ever agrees on what the real national culture is. So everybody thinks nations should have a culture, but the natives in the nation can't agree on what it is. And so you get huge kind of political arguments. And, you know, you see this in the United States. Let's say an argument about, let's just say Black History Month. Could be any issue, but take that one. What is the relationship of African-American history to American history? How do we put the two together? How do you bring it into the public school curriculum? How do you bring it into the cycle of rituals, holidays, celebrations? People argue over these things, and sometimes the arguments get quite heated and, you know, I guess even violent at some points.
And, of course, English as the official language is another example of folks insisting that we need some type of legislation to support the language because it's very American to feel threatened by immigration. It goes all the way back.
And it's also very American to think that, it's very nationalist to think that unity depends on sharing a language. And, of course, there are plenty of places in the world where people are routinely bi- or trilingual, and there are even places in the world which are multilingual and define their own culture in terms of their multilingualism as opposed
Interesting.
To... Interesting. Yeah. This drives academics nuts because we think, you know, what's better than learning two or three or four languages?
Right.
But the kind of common conception is that... To have national unity, you must have language unity. And I can give you lots of good examples. I don't know if we're going to run out of time here. But.
Why don't we do this? We'll take a quick break here for a little local news and weather and pay some bills, and we'll continue this discussion on the other side of this break with anthropologist Richard Handler. This is Charlottesville Right Now on News Radio 1070 WINA. Let's continue our discussion with anthropologist Richard Handler of the University of Virginia. He joins us in studio. Before we left off, we were talking about this idea of here in the West how we identify a shared language as a characteristic of a successful, powerful nation state, and that we are threatened by a multi-language identity. And you were saying that there are some nations that define a powerful nation as everyone being able to speak many languages.
Yeah, or many. There are places in the world where the idea that a group should have only one language doesn't make any sense at all. I was going to bring up I think we left off with the topic of various dialects or versions of English, and I would say that most Americans speak several versions of English. And you know, when I teach these issues in class, students often get into the question of so-called Black English, and the assumption is that all Americans need to, not only do they need to speak English, but they need to speak a certain English, and because if they don't, they won't understand each other. And I always find that curious because there are so many figures in various cultural domains in arts and entertainment who are African American artists whose language is not middle class a dialect, and yet we all understand them. But as soon as we think, but then we think, well, such a language couldn't be effective in the business world because no one would understand them. And yet, of course, we do understand them. And in fact, in the case of, let's say, hip hop artists, they might make a very successful business out of speaking that language.
Right. That's one segment of the business world where you should be speaking that.
There's a kind of disconnect between our idea that everybody needs to speak the same way and the reality that we all daily engage in which we encounter lots of people with various kinds of English, and we make do, or we enjoy it even, talking to different kinds of people with different accents and languages.
And we don't necessarily stop instantly and say, wait a minute, I can't talk to you because you're speaking exactly like some preconceived notion of what is real English.
Yes, and I, since we have been talking about anthropology, I should say that alongside cultural anthropology and archaeology, another one of our subfields is called linguistic anthropology, and linguistic anthropologists often study the social valuing of language. So it's one thing to ask the question, can you understand the English of a hip-hop artist? And the answer may be yes. But it's another thing to say, do you value that dialect, and would you want your child to speak that dialect, or would you like the President of the United States to speak that dialect? And of course, it's very strange because we often have we've had several white Southern men who've been president recently, from certainly the present President Bush, and then you had Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter. Those guys all speak a fairly heavy regional English, but nobody questions that as being inappropriate for the president to speak.
Yeah, and nobody, when Kennedy came down, it came forth and spoke that New England, heavy New England accent, it was the same thing. There was no sense that the issue then, of course, was not his accent, but his religion.
Yes, yes. Or, you know, and you could even talk about liberals who dislike or despise, you could even say, President Bush and ridicule him for his use of language, which, of course, overlooks the fact that he's a fairly effective speechmaker in many contexts. So, you know, coming from the other direction, one might say the man can't use the language, but he
can make a heck of a speech.
In some cases, yes. Yeah. Anyway.
Anthropologist Richard Handler, our guest, you know, we've sort of been talking about this idea of real English, and I know this is another topic that you have studied as well in your career, and it makes me think of, you know, when George Allen made the macaca comment, one of the things he also made almost in the same sentence that a lot of folks might forget is he made reference to the fact that, you know, he was down in the real Virginia. The real Virginia is rural.
Yeah.
It's predominantly white. It's often poor. And that as you get closer to the urban centers of Virginia, that's somehow less real.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating, what should we say, cultural obsession. I mean, first of all, the notion of the real is one that philosophers have puzzled over for centuries and will continue to do so. In relationship to nationalism, which we've been discussing, as I said before, nationalists have a notion that there is a national culture that everyone recognizes. That's the real culture. That's the real us, or the real we. But then it turns out that nobody can agree on what it is. Now, in the case of Allen in southwestern Virginia, one of the things that's fascinating there is that, of course, much of America, if not most of America, is urban. But there's this notion that the real America is the so-called heartland. I mean, why is Iowa more American than New York City, which probably has more people in it and certainly more cultural influence in a lot of ways? Well, one answer to that is that these ideas are related to, well, ultimately, this is a secular version of the narrative of the biblical fall. That is to say, there's a moment of pristine purity from which we have fallen. And the urban world, and this is an old pattern in the West, the urban world represents a kind of corrupt civilization, and the farmer, the pastoralist, the people in the garden represents a purity. And that gets transposed into the political domain in this example of George Allen in southwest Virginia.
A tradition which goes right back to the writings of Thomas Jefferson.
Yes, of course.
That was his vision for America, that we would return to this Eden, this bucolic Eden, where we would have the citizen farmer who would put down the plow every now and then and go to Richmond, and then but not, you know, it certainly wouldn't occupy his time, and he would just spend a couple of months down there. And
yeah, and what's puzzling is why people think that to be a farmer is more real than to be an auto mechanic or a lawyer or a radio announcer. You know, they're all honorable professions. But it has to do with the associations that we make with the word nature or the natural, notwithstanding the fact that most kids, the only chicken they know is the chicken that comes from a fast food restaurant or maybe wrapped in cellophane. That's their reality.
Anthropologist Richard Handler is our guest. Now, you studied this idea of the real. This was at the heart of your study of Colonial Williamsburg.
Well, actually, both Colonial Williamsburg and Quebec. In the case of Williamsburg, you have a nonprofit institution which is dedicated to presenting the past to the public, a particular slice of the past, the American Revolutionary past in Virginia. And then the problem becomes to know, how do you know what it really was? And in a museum like Williamsburg, that question of the real becomes doubly or triply complicated, because not only are they writing about it and talking about it, they're actually trying to reproduce it. And, you know, another peculiarity of our notion of the real is that we think that things are more real than words. So we say things like sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, which of course isn't true. Words are probably more painful than sticks and stones in many cases. Williamsburg is stuck with the problem not only of figuring out what the real story was, but then reproducing it as a physical reality.
How have you seen that story that Williamsburg has shared? How has it changed over time, and what do you see happening there now?
Well, the long-term implication, you know, I haven't been back there, only as a visitor have I been back there. I haven't studied it for a while. But the long-term trajectory that everybody's dealing with is how do you bring into our national accounts of the American experience the experiences of people who were excluded from those accounts. So that's the question of Black history, or the question of Native Americans, or the question of how we understand World War II from the perspective of these various people, or any other war for that matter. And that's a process that goes on slowly, but not, there are peaks and valleys. And the interesting thing about George Allen and the Makaka moment is that, one can imagine that 10 years ago that wouldn't have swayed an election. But for whatever reason, now we're at the point where there are enough people in Virginia that just don't want to hear someone say that, which is kind of interesting. I don't know why that's the case, but it's interesting.
And barely half, because half of Virginia still voted for him, despite Makaka.
Right.
And that's not to say that the other half who didn't vote him voted against him only because of Makaka.
That's right. But presumably there are, there are lots of people of ethnic backgrounds or personal backgrounds that don't conform to what George Allen or some politicians might think is a real Virginian. But of course, if you live in the state, if you're a resident and a citizen, then you're a real Virginian.
Richard Handler is an anthropologist at the University of Virginia and associate dean in the College of Arts and Sciences. Thank you, my friend. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This interview will be archived in its entirety on the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit sevillepodcast.com for more.